You feel that tickle? You won't find it on any doctor's calendar of seasonal allergies, but every year, usually about this time, it returns. Yup, once again, the dust is starting to settle on a just-completed session of the Indiana General Assembly. No Hoosier, of course, is immune to the fallout, but the reactions of those in and around the State House vary widely. Some experience headaches, generalized soreness, and even watery eyes, while others turn euphoric. For those who fall into the first group, the only known treatment is a return to the State House in January, and if that doesn't work, another round of legislative elections. Hi, I'm John Schwannis, and on this, the final show of Indiana Lawmakers 2013 season, we'll take a clear-headed look, I hope, at who ended the session in each category and why. We'll get started, as we have each week since January, with a legislative update from the StateHouseFile.com, a service of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism.
Governor Mike Pence started the 2013 session of the General Assembly arguing with skeptical legislative leaders for a 10% cut in the state income tax rate. It's a promise he campaigned on, and it was the centerpiece of his State of the State address in January. 4 months later, Pence got half the cut he wanted to be implemented in twice the time.
And so we came into this process right to the end, vigorously advocating for what we thought was going to be the best tax relief for Hoosiers. But in the end, I'm convinced that a combination of income tax relief, full repeal of the inheritance tax, and a tax relief to strengthen our financial institutions in Indiana was just the right tax relief at the right time.
Democrats, though, say the tax cuts are pathetic. House Minority Leader Scott Pelath calls the package a lose-lose for Hoosiers.
Because basically they're told the middle class that they can live without revenues that are necessary to help them. Those revenues will just dissipate. And at the same time, it doesn't put any money in their pockets. It's the worst of both possible outcomes.
House Speaker Brian Bosma says the cuts will put more than $1 billion back into the state's economy over the next several years. And he says that's a signal that Indiana is a place to be.
The mere fact that we're cutting income taxes in a substantive way, I think it's going to make us stick out from the rest of the crowd while we're not covering that cut with other tax increases. That's what's happening elsewhere.
Lawmakers are also increasing money for roads, schools, and universities, paying down state debt and expanding a private school voucher program. And this summer, lawmakers will study whether to move forward with state-funded preschool and put staff with guns in every school. For Indiana Lawmakers and the StateHouseFile.com, I'm Brittany Muncy.
Back in a moment with our roundtable discussion, Indiana Lawmakers, from the State House to your house.
Purdue Research Park. 4 locations, 200 companies, 4,000 jobs. Purdue Research Park. The idea economy is here.
Here to look back at the 2013 General Assembly are four people who spent the past 4 months in the proverbial trenches, chronicling the session's key legislative battles and trying to make sense of it all for their respective audiences throughout the state. Ed Feigenbaum, our regular Indiana Lawmakers political analyst and publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight. Leslie Stedman Weidenbinner, managing editor for the StateHouseFile.com, a news website produced by students in Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism. Brandon Smith, State House news reporter for Indiana's public broadcasting stations, and Nikki Kelly, State House bureau chief for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Thank you all for interrupting your naps, post-session naps, to come and talk about the session that was. Now, what's the phenomenon when two people can look at the same thing and see dramatically different images or results? And that strikes me what I saw in some of the day after commentary where Mike Pence was saying, you know, this is one of the most substantive civil sessions in recent memory. And then you look at Scott Pelath, the Democratic House caucus leader, who says, and I wrote it down, a session of promise that ended with a state suspended in stagnation. And of course, he called the state's 2-year budget a sham.
And so nobody did a fly around.
Not yet, maybe. You suggested that, so maybe that's in the offing. Who's right? Which is closer to reality, in your opinion?
Yes. I think everybody came away with a little bit of everything this session, and I think just the fact that we got through a civil kind of session where there was civil discourse, people weren't sniping at each other the whole time, and we were able to actually pass some legislation with real bipartisan support, shows some good things for the future. I think we saw a precursor of what could be if everybody continues to cooperate.
About 300 bills. I actually didn't go back and research how that would compare with other budget sessions, but I mean, that's a fairly substantial number, I suppose, of pieces of legislation. Leslie, you this notion of civility. You wrote a column as the dust was settling on the session, saying that there was this talk of sham and a lot of back and forth in the closing hours of the session when nerves were people were getting tired and nerves were getting raw. But you said, ignore that. The session was, as Ed suggests here, civility through and through.
It was definitely more civil. I do, I was struck though by something Ed Delaney said to us recently, which was, though, if civility means not really getting anything done, is like, what's the point? And so I don't think civility, as a means, is only important if it's a means to an end. If they had come together on legislation that was significant and accomplished something that everybody agreed was a great thing to do, that would be one thing. But they just didn't do very many things that were very controversial that required them to come together on. So the biggest things they did, expanding vouchers, passing more abortion regulations, the budget, those things were not bipartisan. And so they might have all gotten along better, but I don't think it was a sign that they came together to do something significant.
Of course, now there were points in the session where things could have gotten even more contentious than they did if some of the bills that had been introduced and had gotten a lot of headlines and a lot of attention had maybe survived longer than they did or didn't make that one-way trip to the Rules Committee, which some bills do. But, I mean, there was an agreement, of course, to put the proposed constitutional amendment, the second swipe at that bill for same-sex marriage, the tort reform, which kind of came out of nowhere in the early weeks of the session, which went bye-bye, the teaching of creationism, school prayer, sort of the social issues that maybe potentially could have changed the tone, the tenor of the session. Accident that those went to Rules Committee and other places, or is this part of the design, do you think, going into the session?
Yeah, the only one that really got through was the abortion drug bill. Everything else, I think the Speaker wanted to kind of, it was more the Speaker, Speaker Brian Bosma, than the Senate, who was really kind of shuttering those things to the side, I think. And I think he just wanted to focus on the issues he wanted to focus on and didn't want to get crowded in with all the noise that those sorts of things would have created. But things like, for instance, the gay marriage amendment, the constitutional right to hunt, fish, and farm, which would have generated a lot of controversy, didn't make its way over to the House side, or didn't get anywhere in the House side. These sorts of things you can hold off till next year because of the way the process works. So, yes, they didn't get anywhere this session, but that doesn't rule them out in the future, and I think we'll likely see a lot more of that stuff in the shorter session.
So what, is it the suggestion that it would be harder for leadership, for David Long and Brian Bosma, to keep those issues at bay, or is it a matter that they have a session under their belts where they've made the commitment, hey, we're going to focus on job creation, we're going to focus on an honestly balanced budget, we did that, we've checked that box, so now let all those bills come forward.
That's part of it, and it's also the first session for a lot of lawmakers. This is a young, in terms of legislative experience, General Assembly. So to kind of ride through, a lot of the rookies, essentially, without having to delve into all those issues, focus on something like the budget. In a short session, there's less really substantive things you have to tackle, like the budget, and so a lot of this stuff will crop up then.
But you do have to look at the calendar and notice there's an election coming up, too.
I was going to say, I want to jump in about the election, though, because one of the things is I think Republicans are still trying to figure out what the last election meant. And so I think one of the things Brian Bosma is doing is trying to determine what issues are going to play best with the public. I think you're right, a short session is a ripe place for a lot of the sort of crazier things to come up, because you don't have that budget sort of hanging over you. But at the same time, it's very possible the Republican leaders could decide this crazy stuff is not gonna play very well at the ballot, at the polls, and so we're not gonna go in that direction. And I think they're still trying to make that calculation.
And do you think there was an additional pressure on Republicans? I've heard people speculate about this. It used to be budget years meant automatic special session when there was divided leadership. And I heard somebody opine this year that, the last thing that the Republican supermajorities in both chambers and a Republican in the governor's office could afford is this notion of gridlock when one party controls everything. I mean, was that on the back of their minds, do you think?
Oh, yeah. There was no way we were going to a special session. And frankly, the dividing points in the budget there toward the end were so small, lots of us weren't even covering the budget at the end because they were down to very tiny, things. We were covering the ag gag bill, which died on the last night. The drug testing for welfare people, again, died on the last night. There toward the end, we had that week of we're going to arm everyone in schools, and then Brian Bosman came back, and he was sort of the adult in the room, and that went away. The budget actually took, I mean, it has points during the session where it takes precedence, but there were so, you know, they agreed on 90, 95% of the stuff, and we're just sort of, you know, tweaking around the edges. So there was no chance.
You know, the bills you mentioned about the died in those last 12 hours, why is that, do you think? I mean, if, for sake of discussion, I can understand the argument why contentious social issues would have been cast aside earlier in the session. Nobody wants the delay, and we want to appear as a state that we're moving forward in lockstep toward a single goal. But in the last hours, you have supermajorities. I mean, why not satisfy the factions of the caucus? I don't know if it's a rhetorical question or if there's even
well,
an
no,
answer.
I think it's a product of Republicans thinking that Republicans will get along easily, and so not understanding that within their own party there are liberal Republicans and conservative Republicans, and the fact that you can't put off everything until the last minute. I mean, Brian Bosman said on the last night that he urged his folks to get their conference committees done, get all those compromises finished earlier in the week. They didn't do that. They waited until the last minute for so many things. And when you do that, and you are bound to make mistakes. And there were mistakes in a few of those things, or I think some of the bills were not written in a way that they really intended them to be. And then you get in these situations where all of a sudden it's not coming together. And when they're about ready to vote on the budget, everything else goes aside.
And Bosma said to us that night that he didn't, there was a point in the evening where he wasn't very comfortable with how things were going. He didn't like all the mistakes that seemed to be cropping up, particularly with the budget, that it was released Thursday, but then it had to be completely redrafted because of an error, and we kept waiting for the revised vision to come out, and he just didn't like the way things were going. So I think for him, in some ways, killing some of this stuff was better than passing something that ended up being a mistake.
And that's a maturity of leadership that I'm not sure we would have seen from Brian Bosma just a few years ago.
And the last night was absolutely fascinating. The so-called ag-gag bill in particular went through, I want to say, five or six different permutations before it looked like it was finally dead. And then once it appeared to be dead, there was talk that it was just going to be concurred in by the Senate. So all of a sudden it was alive again until leadership finally killed it. And I think that one of the things that ultimately brought it to its knees was when a Republican legislator finally stood up and did almost a dramatic reading from, you know, one of the muckrakers back in the early 1900s, talking about conditions in industrial settings and agricultural settings, and followed by Democratic leader Pilaf with the Upton Sinclair story as well. And the speaker just interrupted him and said, you know, let's end things here. I'm going to withdraw the bill. But I think overall it was really a cathartic kind of session. We needed a session, and yes, the bar was pretty low on some of the legislation that everybody agreed on. You know, the workforce development bill that the Democrats and Republicans all came together.
Not a single nay vote in either chamber,
yeah,
right?
And you know, the joint news conferences on that, you know, it was a little bit overdone, perhaps, but...
Well, we kept hearing, we're not Congress. It's as if, you know, they've done the polling and they know that Congress
That's
is
right.
the boogeyman.
Absolutely.
And whatever you do, we're not going to be Congress.
And sure, the bar was low, but we kind of needed that. I mean, there was a point that you remember back in 1994, after that long special session, budget session in 1993 that went to the very last, literally, hour. On June 30th, 1993. The legislature came back the next year, and the leaders said, the Republican and Democratic leaders said, you know, we just can't keep doing this. And they were out by Valentine's Day that year. They didn't accomplish anything, but the people were happy. The people were glad that they were finally cooperating and that things could happen, that they didn't have to go to a special session. And even though we didn't see a whole lot of real legislating then, and perhaps on some of the real controversial issues this time around, I think people are happy with the way things turned out, and we're really kind of getting a head start toward 2014 right now. Senator Long joked on the final night of the session that we've got we have to have the Legislative Council meet early this year, May 23rd, I believe, because he said we've got about 2,500 study committees we've created.
Yeah.
But some of those are very substantive, and they're going to lead to real legislation next year. If the governor chooses to veto a couple of bills, I think some of those may be back in study this summer too, so that we can have a better drafted set of legislation and not have to worry about that last night kind of issue where people were wondering, you know, if the ag gag bill, for example, was really constitutional as written.
Well, yeah, I mean, you mentioned people wanted, Hoosiers wanted this kind of legislation, this session, I should say, that was cathartic, you know, people can get along. I know legislators, when you ask them questions, they say hypotheticals, they say we don't answer hypotheticals. Since you're not office holders, maybe you'll answer a hypothetical. How much of this was about new faces in the caucus leadership seats in both the House and Senate Democratic caucus? In other words, and here's the direct hypothetical question, if Pat Bauer and, say, Vi Simpson had still been in those two seats respectively in those leadership roles, would we have had the same kind of tone, or would it have been different?
I think the tone would have still been better. I mean, you didn't have right to work. I mean, right to work caused a lot of the dissension over the past couple of years. That was over. And so I do think it still would have been better, but there's no doubt that Brian Bosma and Scott Pelath have a much better, much more respectful relationship. And Scott Pelath has a really unique ability to be frustrated and to make a minority point and then kind of be able to step away from it and laugh a little about the situation and move on. And it's really serving the Democrats, I think, well. I think that the change in the Senate was somewhat less significant.
Well, but it occurred for different reasons, too.
Sure.
It was not a uprising, a coup.
But I mean, you know, Tim Lannon has the same ability to have a really good soundbite about something that he's very frustrated about, but at the same time still have a respect for Senator Long that doesn't disrupt the process.
Of course, we have the new faces in legislative leadership. We also had a new face kind of down the hall and around the corner and down in the governor's office. And we heard a lot about how even Brian Bosma said that there was a learning curve there, that it went from being Nikki sort of a, you know, he started with one direction, maybe not a fully mature agenda. That's not Brian Bosma's words, but that was my inference. To somebody who was fairly involved, apparently.
I mean,
for
the first few weeks, I don't think anyone knew what his agenda was. We were asking and asking, asking. I mean, we had broad outlines in his roadmap, but you know, what bill was that in? How was that being translated into a public policy? We had no idea. I will say, by about the halfway point, well, first of all, he did give us an agenda, but also by about the halfway point, you could tell the Pence administration had maybe kicked it in gear a little. They started commenting on other bills besides their own, started getting a little more involved in the debate outside just their agenda. And I think toward the end, according to Speaker Bosma and Senate President Pro Tem Long, he definitely stepped into some things. I think he controlled how the gaming bill went down in the end, and he
had a lot of influence on Rockport.
Yes, and a lot of influence on Rockport. So
Common
I think by
too,
the end, he really stepped in where he wanted to and needed to on the legislative side, but it was definitely a little rough at the beginning.
And I think it was telling initially when you would ask him about a specific bill that you wanted him to opine on, he would say, well, we won't look at any of that until it reaches my desk, which is a terrible tack to take, because if you want it to look a certain way, you have to be involved in the process before that. Early on, he was saying that. As we got further in the session, he stopped using that line, and he would still find a way not to answer questions a lot of times about specific pieces of legislation.
He's a master at that, isn't he?
He is.
Sometimes he literally just says, I'm not going to answer that.
And or, I think he even made a joke.
Yeah. Next
boy, that one's a hard one. That's a tough one to dodge.
Who's got the next question?
Right.
It just throws you off a little bit.
Well, the stumper for me, I remember back in, you know, the first week or two of the session when Mike Delf, a senator, came forth with this bill that he said, the tort reform bill we talked about a moment ago, where the loser would be required to pay effectively in civil litigation. And Mike Delf said this is the governor's agenda. And I remember the governor was sitting there, and you say, you really couldn't get a sense of where that was in his pecking order.
You've got new people in an administration, a brand new administration. We're comparing the first year of Mike Pence, who had never been in an executive capacity, against essentially the eighth year of Mitch Daniels after 7 years of experience dealing with these people and largely a bipartisan kind of a setting, although not a bipartisan kind of management style. So I think it's a little bit unfair. And you know, there's the old Bill Clinton joke about William Henry Harrison in the first 100 days as well. I think I'm doing pretty good, you know, here. In 100 days, William Henry Harrison didn't even make it past 68. You know,
yeah.
Great Hoosier. But
that's why people remember to wear jackets during their inauguration,
right,
now on cold days.
And Mike Pence didn't, or did he? I can't recall. There was a cold.
He's made it past 100 days, so I guess we're safe there. But
But still, he did get involved at the halfway point. In the last 2 weeks of the session, he was meeting daily with Senator Long and Speaker Bosma, and Speaker Bosma in particular was communicating what he was saying to at least members of the caucus and the media. Now, whether he was implying what the governor was going to do or inferring from some of the things that the governor had said what was going to happen, he made it clear
that... maybe a mix of the two, perhaps.
Yeah, that some bills weren't going to see the light of day if they were drafted and presented in certain forms. And that was very, very helpful because it also gave the governor a little bit of deniability and a little bit of flexibility in the process as well. And then, you know, the governor, obviously, at the end can come out and say and do whatever he wants to do, and the governor took full credit for, you know, a better tax proposal package than his initial signature 10% individual income tax cut proposal. And, you know, he's free to do that, but, you know, he was involved in that, signed off on that.
Well, he's also the one who stays in the state house when everybody else goes home and has the bully pulpit to sort of advance the, you know, the spin, if you will.
But
I don't mean that in a derogatory way of the session.
But he didn't do that like we've seen other governors in the past several
decades
do. Hence
the fly around you talked about.
Go all around the state talking about what a wonderful session it was, how great he did, and how great, oh, yeah, with the help of the legislators, you know, this was for the people of Indiana.
Cool. I do think what Ed brings up about comparing Mike Pence's first year to the Mitch Daniels' eighth year or even the last few years is really important because there is no doubt that in those first month or two of the Pence administration, it was pretty frustrating. And you had to keep reminding yourself, okay, what was it like when Mitch Daniels in his first few months, and you know what, it was really frustrating. And what was it like in Frank O'Bannon's first few months? It was really frustrating. It's just because any kind of change, whether, you know, it's frustrating for lawmakers, it's frustrating for reporters, it's frustrating for everybody involved because you don't, it's a change, you don't quite know what's going on.
Yeah, this struck me also as the year of sort of the safety valve or pressure valve when, especially there in the bottleneck of those final hours. In two ways, you had several high profile pieces of legislation where the enactment date wasn't the typical July 1st. You know, it was criminal code overhaul was what, July 1st mm-hmm. of 2014. You had the tax cut, instead of being phased in the coming months, it would be 2015 and 2017. And then you also had the safety valve of summer study committee, summon the study committee. I mean, it seems like a lot of things are going to study committee. Is that different, do you sense?
I got the sense that they wanted to say they did some stuff, but they also wanted to leave themselves a little wiggle room to fix things, especially with the criminal code bill. I mean, we knew from day one on the criminal code bill that there were fiscal issues, and we got to the end of session, we still had no answer mm-hmm. to the fiscal issues, so we're going to study it this summer, you know, and they can tweak it and change it. Obviously, the tax cut, and Senator Kinley isn't even a fan of putting out sort of delayed tax cuts, but I think they want to see how the economy goes before they do a decent-sized permanent income tax cut. So that was a way for them to say they did it, but also give themselves a backstop in case they need to make some changes.
And even on the much ballyhooed gaming tax change, the tax break for promotional play for the casinos, that's sunsetted after a couple of years and requires a study of the impact on the casinos and the state as well. So even on the other end, we're seeing that.
Well, the wiggle room, whoever used that term, it does strike me that that's exactly what we're seeing here. And again, this summer is going to be busy. I don't know if you've booked your vacation yet, but maybe you want to put it aside.
Yeah, my vacation will actually be after all of the study committees have ended because there are a lot. I mean, school safety is going to be something that's studied, and not just because they got into the whole armed personnel mandate rigmarole during the session. They were already going to study it because that was something the governor had pledged to do. So that, the criminal code reform bill, which they all along had said that they were going to study over the summer because they didn't get nearly enough done before session, even after 4 years of trying to put that together. So you have all those things. We're probably going to
voucher.
They're going to study vouchers a little more.
Mass transit. I mean, as Senator Ballard in Indianapolis said, we studied it to death. Yeah. But I guess it's going to be one more time.
The second half of the tax credit and tax deduction study is up this summer too. Yeah.
So your vacation's off as well. It's. I mean, is it going to be more interesting? I mean, it's.
I just hope that they actually get started. I mean, in the last few years, they haven't gotten started with study committees till August, and then they want to be done. Usually by October. And so the studies in the recent years have not been nearly as significant as they have been in the past. I'm thinking that the Legislative Council, by meeting as early as they're going to meet, getting these things started, intends for it to be a much more serious thing this year. There's no election this year. And so I hope that we see actually a very busy summer.
Well, yeah, in recent years, they have a few meetings. They put a report together that says what people testified. There are no recommendations. Mm-hmm. There are no findings. I mean, I think a lot of us would enjoy some of these study committees a little more if we thought they meant something to the process.
All right. Well, they have an October deadline. You say ours is a little tighter, like now. I appreciate your being with us for this discussion, and I wish we certainly had more time, but we don't have the opportunity for special sessions on this show either, I suppose. Again, my guests have been Ed Feigenbaum of Indiana Legislative Insight, Leslie Stebbin-Weidenbender of thestatehousefile.com, Brandon Smith, Indiana Public Broadcasting Station State House Bureau Chief, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. For more information, episode streams, and extra content, visit us on the web at wfyi.org/lawmakers. And you can get our show on demand from Xfinity and Bright House Network. Well, that concludes another edition and another season of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Chuanis, and on behalf of WFYI Public Media, Indiana's other public broadcasting stations, and thestatehousefile.com, thank you for joining us each week for the past 4 months. Hey, cheer up. The start of the 2014 session is just 35 weeks away. Until then, take care.
The idea economy is here at the Purdue Research Park. A powerful economic engine and a technology conduit from Chicago to Louisville. Purdue Research Park, the idea economy is here.